Welcome to the fourth episode of OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Angelica Welch. OncLive On Air is a new podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information that they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. OncLive is also home to the State of the Science Summits. The summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in therapeutic areas such as breast cancer, lung cancer, genitourinary cancer, hematology, and ovarian cancer. In OncLive On Air, you can expect to hear interviews with academic oncologists on the thought-provoking presentations that they give at these meetings. The topics vary from systemic therapies, surgery, and radiation therapy to emerging therapeutic approaches in a particular disease. That brings us to today's episode. On August 7th, we traveled to Charlottesville, Virginia for a State of the Science Summit on Advanced Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. The conference spanned early-stage advances and emerging treatments for oncogenic-driven disease, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and the role of radiation. First, we sat down with one of our co-chairs of the meeting, Dr. Richard Hall of the University of Virginia Health System. Here's what he had to say about lung cancer updates from the 2018 AACR annual meeting and the 2018 ASCO annual meeting. Hi, Dr. Hall. Thank you for sitting down with us today to talk about practice-changing updates from these oncology conferences. What are some of the advances in this area?
Really, there were some very seminal studies that were presented at those conferences. So, and one of the big themes that I discussed was combination therapies. So using immunotherapy such as pembrolizumab, atezolizumab with chemotherapy regimens that we've been using for many years in the standard of care. And what we saw from, for example, the KEYNOTE-189 study was a significant improvement in overall survival and progression-free survival for patients with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer who are EGFR NALC negative, who are treatment naive. And so we saw the median overall survival was dramatically different in those patients, not reached in the treatment arm, and 11 months in the standard of care arm. And we also saw the KEYNOTE-407 study that was presented at ASCO, and that study looked at squamous cell lung cancer. What we saw there was very similar, an improvement in overall survival and progression-free survival for squamous cell patients treated with combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy. So those are two studies in particular that I highlighted. We also looked at the EMPOWER 150 study that used atezolizumab with bevacizumab and carboplatin paclitaxel compared to bevacizumab, carboplatin paclitaxel. I also highlighted the CheckMate 227 study that was a combination ipilimumab nivolumab study that was presented at AACR with another update at ASCO in a different treatment arm. So combination therapies are really now where we're going in lung cancer, where we have more and more complex treatment options to give to patients. We're seeing sort of the ability to give combination therapy to patients has dramatically increased just in the past year, and I think outcomes for patients, we're seeing that we're really helping a greater number of patients with advanced lung cancer.
We saw a lot of combination studies presented in the past year. What does this mean for the landscape?
So I think that, you know, because over half of patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer are diagnosed at stage 4, that clearly we've got to, you know, when patients are diagnosed, we've got to have better treatment options. And you know, the combination of immunotherapy with chemotherapy or combination immunotherapy studies have really allowed us to, for really, I'd say, the first time in quite a while, improve long-term outcomes for patients who are diagnosed with advanced stage disease. Now, certainly, there's a lot more that we need to do to increase screening and try to improve outcomes for earlier stage patients as well. But I think these combination studies give us a hint that combining immunotherapy with chemotherapy in the stage 4 setting, if we can try to use immunotherapy agents earlier in other stages of disease, that would potentially, we think that that might improve outcomes for those patients as well. And the more we can do to improve outcomes in lung cancer, which has been a lethal disease and still is a lethal disease for so many people, would be a great advance.
Is combination chemoimmunotherapy a more predominant approach than combination immunotherapy at this point?
So I actually would agree that combination chemotherapy immunotherapy is probably right now a more dominant approach. I think we still, in order to give combination immunotherapy, such as nivolumab and ipilimumab, we've got to have a way to get tumor mutational burden or obtain tumor mutational burden testing in a more rapid fashion, and then also try to standardize how that testing is obtained before we can actually really see combination immunotherapy applied. Of course, studies where we look at combination immunotherapy compared to combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy are also critically important to perform.
How do these assays for testing tumor mutational burden vary?
So there are some assay differences. So Foundation One, I believe, is 10 megabases or 10 mutations per megabase. But there, what we're seeing in TMB testing is similar to what we saw in PD-L1 testing, that independent labs are conducting their own tests and validating those. And so an in-house or a lab-developed test for TMB, I think there's an open question as to what that means compared to, say, the Foundation One TMB test.
Do the toxicity profiles differ between combination chemoimmunotherapy and combination immunotherapy?
So combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy, the side effect profiles are somewhat similar to chemotherapy, and we see maybe a bit less in the way of immune-mediated side effects. It's a little hard to compare across trials what the adverse events rates are for combination immunotherapy compared to immunotherapy and chemotherapy. But in general, we see clearly more immune-mediated side effects in the combination chemotherapy-immunotherapy study, particularly the CheckMate 227 study, whereas the predominant adverse events that we saw in the immunotherapy-chemotherapy studies, whether it was Empower 150, Keynote 189, Keynote 407, were chemotherapy-induced with potentially some added toxicity, but small percentage increase in added toxicity in the combination arms compared to the standard of care arms at the time.
Where does the standardization for TMB need to come from?
So standardization for TMB, similar to PD-L1, I think the source of that, I think you could argue that does that need to come from the FDA saying that we should have one standardized test? I think I'm not sure the FDA is probably going to take on that role. And I point out the FDA, but any regulatory agency, I'm not sure that regulatory agencies are going to take on that role. So I think it's if we want standardization of those tests, I think in some sense the medical community is going to have to demand it in order to see it to see that come to fruition.
Regarding the studies you spoke about, what are the unanswered questions?
Well, I think one huge unanswered question is for the high PD-L1 expressing patients, is immunotherapy alone, so based on Keynote 24, is pembrolizumab alone superior in overall survival compared to a chemotherapy immunotherapy approach? I think that's a really critical question, because in the high PD-L1 expressing patients, we don't actually know, I would argue. I think for the intermediate PD-L1 expressing patients, chemotherapy and immunotherapy is clearly better. That's based on the Keynote-42 study that was presented at ASCO this year, and then also based on the results from Keynote-189 and 407. So I think that's a critical unanswered question. And I think the role of TMB and PD-L1 and how these two biomarkers, both imperfect, how they interact and how we can select patients based on them is something that we've got to do more about to learn which patients we should be giving which therapies to.
Next, select faculty from this meeting share their thoughts on these updates and what they mean for the field. First up, our co-chair, Dr. Ryan Gensler of the University of Virginia Health System, reflects on the role of chemotherapy and immunotherapy in the treatment paradigm. Welcome, Dr. Gensler. Can you share how these recent studies have impacted the field of frontline metastatic non-small cell lung cancer?
There's been a lot of progress, I would say, in the last decade or so of moving away from chemotherapy. We've now identified multiple different oncogenic driver mutations that exist in lung adenocarcinoma, and being able to successfully pair a targeted therapy with those genetic mutations has been very successful, and we've been able to at least delay the need for chemotherapy in a large portion of patients. More recently, we've identified that immunotherapy can be quite effective in the rest of the population, including those who are smokers and don't have these oncogenic driver mutations. And our hope has always been that maybe we can get away from cytotoxic chemotherapy and the side effects that come along with those treatments, and can be replaced with a single agent of a tyrosine kinase inhibitor targeting a mutation or an immunotherapy drug that was more of a catch-all for everyone else. What we found in the data that's been released over the last year or so is that chemotherapy still seems to have an important role. And when we add chemotherapy to an immunotherapy regimen, it seems as though there may be a better chance of a response or a longer duration of response. And certainly the way that several studies have been designed of looking at chemotherapy as a backbone, adding immunotherapy onto that has helped patients not only be more likely to respond up front to the treatments, have a longer progression-free survival, but also live longer with now trials that are showing overall survival improvement by adding PD-1 or PD-L1 drugs to our standard chemotherapy.
Besides KEYNOTE-189, what other chemoimmunotherapy combinations are we looking at?
So there are several chemotherapy combinations that have been looked at. The KEYNOTE-189 trial looked at pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy. There's also been a similar trial that was for patients with squamous cell lung cancer that looked also at platinum doublet chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. That was the KEYNOTE-407 trial that also showed a survival improvement in that group. There's been a combination chemotherapy plus atezolizumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, plus bevacizumab. That has also resulted in overall survival improvement compared to chemotherapy alone. We have data from immunotherapy combinations like ipilimumab and nivolumab that have been compared to chemotherapy alone, particularly in a subset of patients that have a high tumor mutational burden. That was the CheckMate 227 trial, and that showed that there was an improvement in progression-free survival with that combination. And there's one other one I wanted to highlight. Oh, and also from the CheckMate 227 trial, that study had multiple arms, and one of the subsets that was looked at was in the low PD-L1 expression group, comparing chemotherapy plus nivolumab to chemotherapy alone. And there was also an improvement in progression-free survival within that comparison group as well.
How do you decide between giving a chemoimmunotherapy combination versus a single agent or combination immunotherapy?
So I think that the data that we have now suggests that chemotherapy plus immunotherapy is the only combination strategy we have that's been shown to show an overall survival improvement. And so I think that the chemotherapy backbone is still an important one for patients, certainly in subsets of patients who maybe PD-L1 negative or tumor mutational burden high. There may be a role for combination immunotherapy alone in that group, although that regimen has not been compared head-to-head with chemotherapy plus immunotherapy with an overall survival endpoint. We also have, on the other end of the spectrum, the patients with high PD-L1 status greater than or equal to 50%, data from the KEYNOTE-24 trial that showed a consistent overall survival benefit with pembrolizumab alone, not in combination, but pembrolizumab alone compared to chemotherapy.
How do the toxicity profiles of combination chemoimmunotherapy and combination immunotherapy differ?
So the side effects that are associated with chemotherapy plus immunotherapy are largely additive side effects rather than synergistic. And so you get all of the traditional side effects from platinum doublet chemotherapy, and you have the side effects from single agent PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors, and most of the times those are not overlapping toxicities. So a lot of this is what we're accustomed to with chemotherapy, and you add on some additional side effects with immune-related adverse events. The combination of ipilimumab and the combination with nivolumab and ipilimumab is similar to the side effects that we see with single agent PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors, except they occur at a much higher frequency. And so with that combination, we're looking at immune-related adverse events, things like colitis, pneumonitis, that occur at a little bit of a higher frequency than with single agent immunotherapy. But when you're giving that regimen, you're not having any of the hematologic toxicity profile that we see with chemotherapy.
Is TMB ready for clinical use?
So I think when digesting all the information from these new trials, if we have PD-L1 and TMB and these biomarkers readily available, we are allowed to fully use this information from these trials and make decisions based upon it. One of the challenges is that TMB is not currently a well-standardized, readily available test that can be turned around in a fast enough time for most patients. Certainly there are some patients who have tissue available and have delays for other reasons who we have time to gather that information. But if it takes 3-4 weeks to get those results, sometimes patients need to get started on treatment before that. So that's one limitation with using the ipilimumab nivolumab up front as a first-line therapy.
What is the greatest challenge in treatment following the results of these studies?
So I think one of the challenges that we have with all of these new chemotherapy and immunotherapy regimens is knowing which to choose for an individual patient. And certainly, if you have an intermediate PD-L1 status and an unknown TMB status or a low TMB status, should these patients get chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab? Should they get ipilimumab and nivolumab if they're high TMB in a high PD-L1 group? Even in the high PD-L1 group, there are some patients who may derive some benefit from getting chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. And we see that with the KEYNOTE-189 trial, where there appears to be a higher response rate of 60% compared to the KEYNOTE-24 response rate of 45%. So I think individualizing all of these options for a specific patient is a challenge. Is the patient highly symptomatic and needs the best chance at a response up front? Or do they have more time to wait and try a monotherapy regimen that maybe has a lesser chance of responding up front, but the same durability?
Will we still see the use of chemotherapy in, say, 10 years?
I'm hopeful that other combinations, whether it's immunotherapy combinations or targeted therapy plus immunotherapy combinations, that we can continue to save the side effects of chemotherapy for a larger proportion of patients. But I do think that there will be subsets of patients where chemotherapy or even chemotherapy alone without immunotherapy will still be an important tool in our armamentarium.
Thank you, Dr. Gensler, for your thoughts on these combinations. Next, we hear from Dr. James Larner of the University of Virginia Cancer Center on the resistance to immunotherapy and how radiation may inform future treatment decisions down the line. Welcome, Dr. Larner. What is the relationship between radiation and immunotherapy?
You know, immunotherapy has had a tremendous impact on lung cancer and other solid tumors. The real question in my mind is why patients become resistant to immunotherapy. If we can figure out the mechanisms of resistance, we have the potential to manipulate the system and avert resistance and increase response rates. Now, radiation typically, historically, has been thought of as a DNA damaging agent. And over the past decade or more, there's been interest in the use of radiation therapy to stimulate the immune system. I think radiation has tremendous potential in that regard. Radiation increases antigen presentation. It increases dendritic cell activity through the recognition of the damage-associated molecular pattern with release of ATP, calreticulin, high mobility group proteins, and so forth and so on. And this results in this so-called abscopal effect, whereby if you radiate a lung cancer or a metastatic deposit in the left lung, you can see regression in the right lung or in the liver. So it's potentiating immune blockade, immune checkpoint blockade. And I think there's a lot of unknowns mechanistically And practically, in terms of the how you integrate radiation with immune checkpoint blockade, which comes first? Do you give the radiation first? Do you give the immunotherapy first? What dose of radiation is optimal? Recently, there have been several molecular pathways that have been identified, including the C-gas sting pathway, where damaged DNA goes into the cytosol and turns on an interferon response that leads to dendritic cell stimulation. If you give too high of a dose or too low of a dose, you may not get that response. So I think the real future is understanding the many potential permutations and pathways that are involved in potentiating the immune response, whether radiation can make a contribution to basically auto-vaccination, getting the releasing the individual tumor antigens of a given of a patient's given tumor to produce a systemic effect.
Have other trials examined the use of chemoradiotherapy and immunotherapy besides PACIFIC?
There's one subset analysis that suggests that if you give the immunotherapy within 2 weeks of chemoradiation, it's more effective. Now, the obvious biological explanation for that is that there are more neoantigens and there's more priming of dendritic cells close to radiation and chemotherapy as opposed to distant to it. But, you know, that's just conjecture.
Thank you, Dr. Larner, for providing perspective on radiotherapy's interaction with immunotherapy. Next, we hear from Dr. Stephen Liu of Georgetown University on the results of KEYNOTE-189. Welcome, Dr. Liu. What do we know following the results of KEYNOTE-189?
So in KEYNOTE-189, we saw a combination of carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab really outperform chemotherapy alone. And this was independent of PD-L1 expression, really setting a new standard for non-small cell lung cancer of non-squamous histology. What's important to remember is that those studies excluded patients with EGFR mutations and ALK rearrangements. And so while that really has changed our standard of care for most non-small cell lung cancer, for patients with a driver mutation, really targeted therapy remains the preferred initial treatment. Really is the preferred salvage treatment as well. Immunotherapy has changed our treatment, our management of non-small cell lung cancer, but the outcomes have been very disappointing in patients with EGFR and ALK alterations. In the second-line setting, response rates are under 5%. In the front-line setting, in a recent study looking at pembrolizumab for EGFR mutant patients with PD-L1 expression, saw no responses. And the concern there is that subsequent TKI use, subsequent use of normally relatively safe drugs, may be influenced by that prior treatment. So the sequence of therapy may have implications really for the duration of that patient's treatment.
Can immunotherapy play a role in patients with oncogenic drivers?
So immunotherapy can still play a role for those patients, and we have a couple things supporting that. We've seen in the initial KEYNOTE studies of pembrolizumab that some of the responders were patients with EGFR mutations. In the original salvage phase 1 nivolumab study, one of the long-term survivors was an EGFR mutant patient. Responses and durable responses are possible, they're just not likely. And those patients are better served by using TKI therapy up front. In the recent EMPOWER 150, we did see that patients with EGFR and ALK alterations were included, and there's some suggestion that those patients may benefit from that. Now, that may be a combination of anti-PD-L1 and anti-VEGF therapies. Immunotherapy is not off the table. In fact, I think it holds a lot of promise. But today, targeted therapy really is the preferred treatment, and the proper sequence as of now should be targeted therapy first, and reserving immunotherapy not just for second line, but really beyond second line and certainly further down the line.
Thank you, Dr. Liu. And thank you for listening to our fourth episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com, sign up for our e-newsletters, and check out onclive.com/stateofthescience to sign up for a meeting in a city near you. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and be sure to follow our LinkedIn page. That's all for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air.